Welcome back, constant listeners. Nick Deolius, the Farm Middle Podcast. Hope you've had a good week. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius and check out the website, nickdeolius.com. Always posting some new thoughts and new information, thought pieces on both, so give them a look when you get a chance. With episode 41, sort of an easy choice on who we're going to dedicate this to. That's going to go to the great Tom Seaver, Tom Terrific. California boy, originally went to Southern Cal, where he was a standout in college playing baseball, and did some research on Seaver just to sort of get you some info beyond the obvious and the statistics. And I learned something, learned a couple of things, actually. First thing I learned was that the Braves were the team that originally drafted him. But when they drafted Seaver coming out of USC, there was some issue that popped up with respect to him playing in exhibition games as almost a pro or semi-pro, which put his status into question, I guess, with respect to how you would draft players at the time. And there was some sort of fight or debate or litigation that ensued, and it ended up where they allowed him to basically be reconsidered by the different teams for the draft, and that's when the Mets came in and drafted him after sort of that accord that they reached. Where originally the Braves had the rights to him, but didn't end up with him. Of course, he went to the New York Mets. And of course, Seaver was part of the Miracle Mets. He was also part, I don't know if you guys are sort of historians when it comes to baseball, but he was part of the Midnight Massacre trades with the Mets, where the Mets, in sort of one fell swoop, traded away Dave Kingman, the great power hitter, along with Tom Seaver, to different teams. They still reference that as the Midnight Massacre in New York. And the rumor was that Seaver sort of wanted a trade, was looking to leave the Mets because he and his wife were somewhat jealous of the money that Nolan Ryan was making through his career, and Tom Seaver considered himself on par with Nolan Ryan. And that was sort of the impetus or the catalyst to have him request an exit from New York. Statistically, amazing career, 300 plus wins, 520 win seasons, 3 Cy Young Awards. Wow, like what a track record. And I also ran this down just to put Seaver in context of pitchers historically in baseball. Only Tom Seaver and Walter Johnson, only those two pitchers in the history of baseball have 300 wins, over 3,000 strikeouts, and a career ERA under 3.00. So that's some pretty exclusive company and a pretty exclusive list of two. I also found out another second sort of factoid for you. When he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, he had the highest percent of votes ever tabulated. That's another amazing statistic in terms of the writers and the voters for getting him into the Hall. Another sort of story about Seaver that was sort of cool, Hank Aaron, Hammer and Hank. And we might be talking about Hank Aaron a little more in a couple of weeks. Just might be a hint for future dedications. But Tom Seaver, when he was a young pro, he approached Hank Aaron before his first All-Star game in 1967. So Seaver gets elected to earns a spot onto the first All-Star game of his career. Hank Aaron, of course, is a perennial All-Star. And he goes up to Hank Aaron and asks for his autograph. And Seaver felt the need to introduce himself to Aaron because he was certain that Hammer and Hank wouldn't know who he was. After Seaver introduces himself, Aaron replies to him, "Hey, kid, I know who you are, and before your career is over, I guarantee you everyone in this stadium will too." Hank Aaron was absolutely correct on that assessment. I remember Tom Seaver, after he had retired, being an announcer on national baseball games with Vin Scully, I think he was partnered up with. I think Tom Seaver replaced Joe Garagiola in the announcer booth when he teamed up with Scully. He also became a wine man in California, had a wine label vineyard type of an endeavor. And there was also a legal spat that Tom Seaver or his legal representatives got involved with Tom Brady. Tom Brady was looking to trademark or copyright the tagline "Tom Terrific," and the Seaver camp says, no, that's already been something that's been created by Tom Seaver. And to allow that that copyright or that trademark to be adopted would basically create confusion and confuse a Tom Brady with a Tom Seaver. So that's another interesting tidbit that I ran across thinking about Tom Seaver. We lost him a couple of years ago, sadly, but with respect to what he was able to achieve on the field, we'll have that for posterity's sake moving forward. So rest in peace, episode 41 dedicated to the great Tom Seaver. Now let's take that dot of Tom Seaver and connect it to our next subject, which is the only thing lower than Tom Seaver's career ERA seems these days to be office occupancy rates in big cities. Now, it wasn't too long ago, and perhaps we're still doing this, where we were blaming remote work and empty offices on COVID, right, with pandemic and everything that that was encountered with respect to managing through it. But that excuse or that view of pandemic or COVID sort of being the reason for very low office occupancy rates in big cities, I think that's been exposed, at least currently, as something that's a flawed assumption or a flawed root cause. And why is that? Well, I think that's the reason because you can see this across different sort of data sets. First off, when you just look at COVID-19, infection rates are plummeting, hospitalizations definitely plummeting post-vaccination availability and with Omicron and all these different variants now not looking to be as severe. And then you look across some other segments of where things are sort of closer to getting back to normal. You look at movie theaters, which were obviously hard hit by pandemic. They are almost at 60% of their levels before COVID. Restaurants are 75% of pre-COVID levels. So restaurants are almost back to full speed. Air travel, 80% of pre-COVID levels. And then NBA attendance, so sort of fans at NBA basketball games, 93% of pre-COVID levels. But, you know, when you get beyond NBA games and air travel and restaurants and movie theaters where things are ramping back up to where they were before COVID, nobody, however, is working at the office. And I just want to give you and read you some weekly occupancy rates for offices in our larger cities from early February, a couple of weeks back. San Francisco, 22% office occupancy rate. New York City, 26%. Chicago, 26%. Washington, D.C., 30% of office occupancy versus capacity. Those are numbers that are not just very, very low, but they have all kinds of follow-on consequences, not any of them good. And how do we get there? Why aren't people returning to the office? Why are those occupancy rates so low? Because a whole slew of policies that were instituted over the past number of years, they drove this erosion of in-person work. And as a result, businesses are going to suffer. And there's going to be two types of suffering, two components to this suffering or this degradation sort of follow-on consequence. One is going to be the companies or teams that are now operating remotely. That is going to be inevitably at a lower level of efficiency, a lower level of intensity, and frankly, a lower level of performance than they would have been if acting, working, and engaging in front of one another as a team. That's just a fact of life. And we can talk about the benefits of technology and all the benefits to work-life balance with respect or with regard to remote work. But the fact of the matter is, if you have individuals across a company or a team that are not seeing one another and engaging with one another and innovating with one another, that is going to lead to a lower level of performance in the end. And I think people and entities and industries are starting to wake up to that. The second side of this damage is with respect to the whole, I'll call it, economic ecosystem that's been built around large cities, downtown areas, large office buildings and office complexes, where you've got all these different companies and the service economy that's just being continually devastated by lack of workers in these office buildings over a long period of time. So it could be restaurants, it could be any of the other service companies you can think of, dry cleaners, clothiers, a whole slew of different people and industries and companies in the service economy that basically have lost their entire customer base. So if you're a restaurant in downtown Manhattan, or if you're a barber in downtown San Francisco, your revenue base and your customer base has been cut by a substantial amount, almost tracks what the office occupancy itself has done because that's where all your customers were. And by the way, this isn't something that should be, you know, sort of hidden. It should be fairly obvious to our leaders of our large urban areas. Why aren't mayors and other political leaders in these regions or cities, why aren't they making huge deals out of this and demanding or creating or instituting policies that would incentivize the exact opposite of what's occurring and what they've done historically under sort of the auspices of managing through COVID? Sort of makes you scratch your head. I saw recently that the mayor of New York City, Mayor Adams, is starting to figure this out and trying to reverse course. But, you know, it might be too little too late. It's about time that that we face this for what it is and put in a policy that makes sense in late February, early March of 2022 instead of something that made more sense when you knew very little, if anything, back in sort of early 2020 when all this was starting to unfold upon the world. I'll just conclude this thought with making one sort of editorial comment to cap it off. The thing that we see with office occupancy rates in our large cities and in downtown areas is the same thing that's happening to school attendance in our public school systems, and the consequences there are even worse, because when you've got kids out of school and going through quote-unquote remote learning, and I put that in quotes because remote learning really isn't learning, you're going to see that manifest, as we've discussed in prior episodes of The Far Middle, when it comes to proficiencies for reading and science and math and writing and all the other things that matter. And this actually brings me to the next idea to discuss on this episode of The Far Middle. It could be PhD economists, it could be elites or leaders from our larger urban areas, but those who look to our big cities and the economies that sort of thrive around our larger urban areas as the ideal, right? That's the place we want to become more of or concentrate more of our efforts with respect to. They'll often lecture us about what they reference as the resource curse. And the resource curse, if you're not familiar with it, this is the idea that whether it's a region or a nation that has access to either commodities of value or energy deposits of value, that they at times or oftentimes will squander that. And thus the resource itself becomes a curse, and hence the name resource curse. Now, sometimes this is a theory that's misapplied or overapplied because it's a convenient way to take a swipe at, say, the carbon economy or manufacturing or sort of extractive industries when it comes to different commodities. What is interesting, however, of note over the past year or so is that when you look at environmentalism and climate change policies, which become more prominent right by the month, they have succeeded cumulatively in reversing the resource curse. What I mean by that, you look at nations such as Iran and Russia and China, they are all on the prowl, and not only are they all on the prowl geopolitically, they're also at the same time, not coincidentally, enjoying high commodity prices or enjoying policies that are boosting the demand for either their commodities or the manufacturing that would go along with whatever you would do with those commodities of processing them and manufacturing them into components like China would with respect to climate change policies that are favoring things like solar panels and wind turbines, where all the stuff to make those exist in places like China. Meanwhile, while those types of nations are benefiting, you've got countries in the West. It could be the UK, it could be the United States here at home, Germany, basically any nation in the EU beyond Germany, all of them fall into this category. What's going on there? We're all suffering. We're suffering inflation spikes. We're suffering hits to real income of households. We're suffering through a spate of geopolitical weakness. And most attention today, rightfully so, is with respect to what's going on geopolitically with Russia and Ukraine, and how Germany, right, and its sort of imposed via policy energy dependence, how that energy dependence on Russia is making Germany a bit of a lightweight, a bit of a wimp when it comes to geopolitics. But I think Iran is another great case in point that nobody out there is paying nearly enough attention to. Recently, our Secretary of State, Secretary of State Blinken, he restored sanction waivers on Iranian civil nuclear activity that the Trump administration had rescinded. And when that happened, Iran's foreign minister said, that's good, that's a start, but it's not nearly enough. You can see, you can just see through the statements and through the actions how much the leverage has shifted away from Iran not long ago, now right into Iran's favor. It's really sort of just striking to see. And this wasn't the most recent example. That was just the most recent example, right? It wasn't the only example, I should say, of unilateral concessions that we're making to Iran. June of last year, not that long ago, everyone today seems to forget that we lifted sanctions on Iranian officials and firms back in last summer. And we ended our fight to put in place what they were calling those snapback sanctions on Iran at the United Nations. And now you look at things like oil exports of Iranian crude, those exports are growing from what was their low point when the sanctions were in place. So all the data, the metrics, the proxies that you can look at to see how leverage is shifting, it's pretty evident that when it comes to Iran, they are firmly now enjoying some control and some leverage that they haven't for some time. In the Biden administration, it continues to, I don't know if you want to call it spinning the truth or slanting the truth, by saying things. Here's a recent quote: "We did not provide sanctions relief for Iran and will not." End quote. Yes, we did, and yes, we will. So the reality is very different than what the Biden administration is wanting to convey. So again, you know, what resource curse? I don't see a resource curse today. All I see is climate policy and environmentalism and the left creating what I would reference more as a lack of energy independence curse for the Western nations. And that brings really us to the next point of when you look at resources and when you look at carbon, does it matter where the carbon dioxide that's being emitted comes from? In the real world of physics and math and science, it doesn't matter. CO2 emitted into the atmosphere is CO2. All has the same impact when it comes to any sort of impacts on climate or those types of things. But when it comes to climate change policies and environmentalism and governments all over the world, the answer is yes, it does matter where the CO2 comes from. Because if you're China, or if you're looking at the Chinese mining and processing and manufacturing of components for wind turbines or solar panels, the CO2 emissions that come with it, which are massive, and the carbon footprint that's associated with it, which is massive, and the surface disturbances beyond carbon and CO2 that are associated with those activities are huge, then that gets deemed as green. That's green, renewable, zero, et cetera, which is nothing more than a fallacy. It's a myth. But if you're looking at the United States and our domestic natural gas industry, let's say, and the pipeline industry that goes with it and petrochemicals, those CO2 emissions tied to those endeavors, that's deemed as dirty. That's deemed as a problem. That's the code red for humanity. Look, the planet does not care where the carbon dioxide is coming from or how it's being emitted. Carbon dioxide is carbon dioxide. And if something like the use or utilization of wind power or solar power, when you add it all up from scopes 1 through 3, upstream all the way through downstream utilization, if that carbon footprint or that CO2 footprint or that energy intensity and energy disturbance footprint is much higher for wind or solar than it is for something like domestic natural gas within the United States, then environmental policy, climate change policy, government policy should be running toward domestic natural gas types of activities and away from Chinese solar, Chinese wind, and the like. But of course, we see the 180-degree opposite, which just tells you that environmentalism and climate change policies and government is more obsessed about religion and ideology today than they are about the science and the facts. And you can go from, you know, the CO2, carbon dioxide being emitted from a planetary perspective, physics perspective, it doesn't matter. It can bring you into the next dot to connect, which is, does it matter how the carbon dioxide or the products that we're talking about are being manufactured? I think it matters tremendously, but society seems to be sort of drawing a blind eye toward it. I'll give you 3 examples of this. We've got first Senator Ron Wyden, who is, of course, a Democrat from Oregon. We've got Nike, who is a global manufacturer of shoes and T-shirts that we're all very familiar with. And we've got Tesla, that, of course, is an electric vehicle manufacturer. So we know all 3 of these well, and they all 3 have 2 things in common, all 3 of these entities. First, all 3 are climate warriors. So all 3 of these, the individual and the 2 companies, they clamor for the zero carbon fantasies. They talk about the climate crisis, et cetera, et cetera. So they, you know, they've got cred when it comes to being the climate warriors that that they warrant themselves to be. Second thing they've all got in common, all 3 seem to struggle when it comes to taking a stance on China, the Chinese Communist Party, and particularly what's going on with respect to labor, or dare I say slave labor, in China. So Senator Wyden, at first, he refused to sign on to legislation that required Xinjiang importers to prove that those goods are not going to be produced with basically slave labor. Eventually, right in the senator's defense, and in fair disclosure, he did relent. So he did agree to vote for that. But, you know, you got to wonder why he took so long to do so. Why was it such a struggle for him? Well, maybe I've got an answer, because it just so happens that a company called Nike is headquartered in his district out there in Oregon. And many out there have been asking for a while as to where Nike's murky supply chain can be traced back to. What is that actual supply chain, and where does it lead you to, particularly in regions like Asia? And who is doing all the work and under what conditions and duress in that Nike supply chain? By the way, most of that murky supply chain and much of the product line of shoes and apparel that we all enjoy from Nike, those are petroleum and carbon-based products. So when you think about it, Nike is a peddler of carbon products. They may not admit it. They may shun carbon sort of on the official PR side of things, but the reality is they should be embracing it because they are definitely peddling carbon products all across their product lines. And then right after Congress and Senator Wyden within Congress passed this legislation that required the importers from Xinjiang to show proof of not using slave labor in the production of the goods, you had an announcement from Tesla. Tesla announced that it was opening a new showroom in, of all places, Xinjiang. Wow. You know, I am a fan of Elon Musk, and how can you not be? He's a very interesting guy. Kudos to him, right, for leaving California and taking on bureaucracy, all that stuff. But those are things that are very consistent with the heart and mind of the Far Middle podcast. But being a sort of climate change zealot and at the same time buying massive amounts of materials and commodities from places like Xinjiang, using who knows what labor practices on human rights abuses and what could be occurring there, and doing all of it on the back of the middle class taxpayers via subsidies that are in the billions of dollars, that's probably a bit too much even for admirers of Elon Musk like myself. So my question that I often wonder aloud is, when will the Senator Wydens and the Nikes and the Teslas, when will they take public stands against the Chinese Communist Party and admit the true carbon footprints of all of those disingenuous zero carbon warranted products and activities are simply not zero carbon? Heck, maybe even just simply acknowledging the existence of Taiwan would be a good start for any of those three. Now, zero carbon fallacies, unfortunately, not unique to U.S. megacorporations and our own blowhard politicians. No, it's not unique to just us. I love to study these things. I'm always on the lookout for them. It's one of my side hobbies. And I study them more and more because these ridiculous announcements and these flawed plans keep coming out from every corner of the globe and every corner of the business community you can think of. Now, you also, when I say every corner of the globe, that also includes an area that I'm great respect for and have been an admirer for many, many years, which is Japan. There is a very well-known, very historic, gigantic electronics manufacturer in Japan. You know the name as well as I do. I'll keep it nameless for this episode of The Far Middle. But just to put the size of this company into perspective, it's got a carbon footprint that is five times the size of Apple. So Apple has a big carbon footprint, being the monolith that it is. This entity is five times as big when it comes to carbon footprint. And what this company, this firm is doing, it is typical of what I call the kabuki theater that you find in these zero carbon plans. The first sort of element of the silliness that you see is with respect to timelines. So this company came out with a target for zero carbon in 2030. Now that's just for its direct emissions, and its target's 2050, for its entire carbon footprint, upstream and downstream. Like any of us are going to remember what the leaders of this company said in 2022, that far down the road. Like, we're going to sit here in 2049 or 2050 and say, well, you hit your target from 2022 or you didn't. It's so far down the road that it's basically meaningless. Also, another sort of element of the silliness was when it announced recently, this was sort of the major news that brought my attention to it, it was happy to announce it hit a major milestone for one of its plants in China. So it had one site, one facility in China. And did it hit zero carbon at the plant? Well, I don't know, because the specific term, and you've always got to be on the lookout for this when it comes to companies and businesses playing games with this whole sort of carbon virtue signaling, because the specific term that this entity used was virtually net zero. Now, what does virtually mean? What does net mean when it comes to the math? What are you netting? Nobody knows. So right away, you see the flaws in the reality versus sort of what I call the PR, the public relations hype. And how did it get to that, you know, virtually net zero, whatever that means, at this Chinese facility? The details, yet another layer of silliness, and it exposes sort of the sham that it is. First, a big way it got there was it replaced human workers with robots. Now, that is not going to help with social justice when we start eliminating family-sustaining jobs across the globe. Another proof point, by the way, of what I said in the prior episodes of The Far Middle, that if you're anti-carbon, you are anti-human. There's a case in point right then and there with this Chinese factory, with this giant firm. Second way it got there, it helped get it there, that is virtual net zero, is that it said it used wind and solar energy. And of course, that's assuming and pretending that wind and solar are zero carbon, which we just said earlier, they're clearly not. It is a joke to claim that wind and solar are zero carbon emitters on a scope 1 through 3 basis. And then the third thing they did, they bought carbon offsets in some type of manufactured rigged market for these credits, buying indulgences, right? For those of you of the Catholic faith and persuasion like I am, so buying your way out of sin or get out of carbon jail free card if you're a Monopoly fan, that's not the same thing as legitimate zero emissions. So the CO2, the carbon dioxide, was still emitted with respect to this firm, this business. It just was bought away and basically bought their way out of it, pretending that it was zero. And oh, by the way, this plant in China, guess what it makes? It makes batteries for electric vehicles, which of course is one of the most carbon intensive and surface disruptive activities known to manufacturing on the planet. So you've got another publicity stunt that's genuflecting at the altar of the climate change gods, coming from this global multi-billion dollar corporation that's exposed as nothing more than basically an exercise in futility and basically a violation of the laws of chemistry, algebra, physics. You can just add them all up. Yet the media, business schools, environmental groups, industry groups are all going to tout this as if it's the Rosetta Stone of sustainability and how you avoid climate doom. It's time for all of us, ladies and gentlemen, to wise up. I could go on and on, connecting dots here all day long, but we're getting close to where it's time to call it a wrap for episode 41 of the Far Middle podcast. I'll save some of these issues and items to discuss for episode 42 in a week. But when I wrap this episode, I do want to wish a happy birthday recently that's just passed for John Steinbeck, the great author. He is one of my favorite all-time authors, top five for sure. And that's funny that I'm saying that because John Steinbeck, for those of you that know him, he had some socialist and left-leaning views of things, both in his writings as well as his political views throughout his life. I am definitely not that, but I have to admit I am an unabashed fan of his work. He's just a fantastic author. And I'm such a fan of John Steinbeck that I actually visited his museum. I drug the kids there with me a number of years ago when we were out in California. It's the Steinbeck Center, actually. I call it the Steinbeck Museum, but it's the Steinbeck Center. It's just outside of Monterey in Northern California, where he was from originally. Awesome facility. If you're ever out in that area of the world, you owe it to yourself to spend a few hours there. You'll really enjoy it. And then people always ask me, well, if my literary friends, that is, well, what are your favorite Steinbeck novels or books? I've got two of them that I just have loved through the years. First one, of course, is East of Eden. That came out in 1952. That was clearly his opus. He had gone on record by saying that everything he did up to that book was nothing more than practice for the real deal that was East of Eden. So he viewed that as his magnus opus. And the word that I can best think of to describe East of Eden would be biblical, because the story that it tells, it parallels a lot of themes and a lot of stories that you will read or come across in the Bible. Now, my second favorite from Steinbeck is Travels with Charlie. Now, Travels with Charlie is a travelogue that he basically recorded or wrote in 1960 with his poodle. His poodle's name was Charlie. So Steinbeck jumped in a camper, took his dog, and he basically drove and circumvented the country across 10,000 miles. At the time, you know, he had some health issues. I think he knew that he was dying, and he probably wanted to see his country one last time and try to record what he observed, what he was feeling as he made that 10,000-mile trek. Someday, you know, I want to recreate that journey that Steinbeck took and find the time to do so. I plan on doing it, and I look forward to that day. But until I start that 10,000-mile journey, maybe with my dog instead of the poodle Charlie, I will speak to you in a week with another exciting episode of The Far Middle.